Chapter 33. Our vast, effectual, and majestic strokes in this unmatched campaign enable me to bar from commerce with the continent all keels of English frame. Hence I decree. Spirit of rumor, this outlines his renowned Erland decree. Maybe he meditates its scheme in sleep, or hints it to his suite, or syllables it while shaping, to his scribes. Voice of Napoleon, all England's ports to suffer strict blockade. All traffic with that land to cease forthwith. All natives of her isles, wherever met, to be detained as windfalls of the war. All chattels of her make, material, mold, to be good prize wherever pounced upon. And never a bottom hailing from her shores, but shall be barred from every haven here. This for her monstrous harms to human rights, and shameless sauciness to neighbor powers. Spirit sinister, I spell herein, that our excellently high-colored drama is not played out yet. Spirit of the years, nor will it be for many a month of moans, and summer shocks, and winter whitened bones. The night gets darker, and the palace outlines are lost. Seen via Tilsit and the River Niemen, the scene is viewed from the windows of Bonaparte's temporary quarters. Some sub-officers of his suite are looking out upon it. It is the day after midsummer, about 1 o'clock. A multitude of soldiery and spectators lines each bank of the broad river which, stealing slowly northwest, bears almost exactly in its midst a moored raft of bonded timber. On this as a floor stands a gorgeous pavilion of draped woodwork, having at each side, facing the respective banks of the stream, a round-headed doorway richly festooned. The cumbersome erection acquires from the current a rhythmical movement, as if it were breathing, and the breeze now, and then produces a shiver on the face of the stream. Dumb show, on the southwestern Prussian side rides the Emperor Napoleon in uniform, attended by the Grand Duke of Berg, the Prince of Neufchâtel, Marshal Bessières, Duroc Marshal of the Palace, and Caulaincourt Master of the Horse. The Emperor looks well, but is growing fat. They embark on an ornamental barge in front of them, which immediately puts off. It is now apparent to the watchers that a precisely similar enactment has simultaneously taken place on the opposite Russian bank, the chief figure being the Emperor Alexander, a graceful, flexible man of 30, with a courteous manner and good-natured face. He has come out from an inn on that side accompanied by the Grand Duke Constantine, General Bennigsen, General Auerhoff, Prince Leibanov, and Adjutant General Count Levin. The two barges draw towards the raft, reaching the opposite sides of it about the same time, amidst discharges of cannon. Each emperor enters the door that faces him, and meeting in the center of the pavilion they formally embrace each other. They retire together to the screened interior, the suite of each remaining in the outer half of the pavilion. More than an hour passes, while they are thus invisible. The French officers who have observed the scene from the lodging of Napoleon walk about idly, and ever and anon go curiously to the windows, again to watch the raft. Chorus of the years, aerial music, the prelude to this smooth scene mark well, were the shocks whereof the times gave token vaguely to us ere last year's snows shut over Lithuanian pine and pool, which we told at the fall of the faded leaf. When the pride of Prussia was bruised and broken, and the man of adventure sat in the seat of the man of method and rigid rule. Semi-chorus I of the pities, snows incarnate and were thine, O Aile, field of the wide white spaces, and frozen lakes, and frozen limbs, and blood iced hard as it left the veins. Steel-cased squadrons swathed in cloud drift, plunging to doom through pathless places, and 40,000 dead and near dead, strewing the early lighted plains. Friedland to these adds its tale of victims, its midnight marches and hot collisions, its plunge, at his word, on the enemy hooped by the bended river and famed mill stream, as he shatters the moves of the loose-knit nations, to curb his exploitful soul's ambitions, and their great confederacy dissolves like the diorama of a dream. Dumb show continues, Napoleon and Alexander emerged from their seclusion, and each is beheld talking to the suite of his companion apparently in flattering compliment. An effusive parting, which signifies itself to be but temporary, is followed by their return to the river shores amid the cheers of the spectators. Napoleon and his marshals arrive at the door of his quarters and enter, and pass out of sight to other rooms than that of the foreground in which the observers are loitering. Dumb show ends. A murmured conversation grows audible, carried on by two persons, in the crowd beneath the open windows. Their dress being the native one, and their tongue unfamiliar, they seem to the officers to be merely inhabitants gossiping, and their voices continue unheeded. First English spy 14, below, did you get much for me to send on? Second English spy, much, and startling too. Hi, are we at war? Says Napoleon when they met. H.Y., said Toter. L, said Boney, I am fighting you only as an ally of the English, and you are simply serving them, and not yourself, in fighting me. In that case, says Alexander, we shall soon be friends, for I owe her as great a grudge as you. First spy, dammy, go that length, did they? Second spy, then they plunged into the old story about English selfishness, and greed, and duplicity. But the climax related to Spain, and it amounted to this. They agreed that the Bourbons of the Spanish throne should be made to abdicate, and Bonaparte's relations set up as sovereigns instead of them. First spy, somebody must ride like hell, to let our cabinet know. Second spy, I have written it down in cipher, not to trust to memory, and to guard against accidents. They also agree that France should have the Pope's dominions, Malta, and Egypt, that Napoleon's brother Joseph should have Sicily as well as Naples, and that they would partition the Ottoman Empire between them. First spy, cutting up Europe like a plum pudding. Par noble fratrum. Second spy, then they worthy pair came to poor Prussia, whom Alexander, they say, was anxious about, as he is under engagements to her. It seems that Napoleon agrees to restore to the king as many of his states as will cover Alexander's promise, so that the Tsar may feel free to strike out in this new line with his new friend. First spy, surely this is but surmise? Second spy, not at all. One of the suite overheard, and I got round him. There was much more, which I did not learn. But they are going to soothe and flatter the unfortunate king and queen by asking them to a banquet here. First spy, such a spirited woman will never come. Second spy, we shall see. Whom necessity compels needs must. And as he has gone through an Iliad of woes. First spy, it is this Spanish business that will stagger England, by God. And now to let her know it. French subaltern, looking out above, what are those townspeople talking about so earnestly, I wonder? The lingo of this place has an accent akin to English. Second subaltern, no doubt, because the races are both Teutonic. The spies observe that they are noticed and disappear in the crowd. The curtain drops. Scene V is the same, the midsummer sun is low, and a long table in the aforeshown apartment is laid out for a dinner, among the decorations being bunches of the season's roses. At the vacant end of the room, divided from the dining end by folding doors, now open, there are discovered the Emperor Napoleon, the Grand Duke Constantine, Prince Henry of Prussia, the Prince Royal of Bavaria, the Grand Duke of Berg, and attendant officers. Enter the Tsar Alexander. Napoleon welcomes him, and the twain move apart from the rest. Bonaparte placing a chair for his visitor and flinging himself down on another. Napoleon, the comforts I can offer are not great, nor is the accommodation more than scant that falls to me for hospitality. But, as it is, accept. Alexander, it serves well. And to embrace the bandages of state is as clear air to incense-stifled souls. What of the queen? Napoleon, she's coming with the king. We have some quarter hour to spare, or more before their majesties are timed for us. Alexander, good. I would speak of them. That she should show hereafter the late events, betokens much. Abasement in so proud a woman's heart, his voice grows tremulous, is not without a dash of painfulness. And I beseech you, sire, that you hold out some soothing hope for her. Napoleon, I have, already. Now, sire, to those affairs we entered on. Strong friendship, grown secure, bids me repeat that you have been much duped by your allies. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.